Proceed when you are.
Very well. Thank you, Your Honor. My name is David Japha, J-A-P-H-A. My bar registration number is 14434. I represent Charles Trogdon, who is presently incarcerated in Canyon City based on the convictions in this case. He's hired me to ask, to persuade you that the convictions should be reversed because of an illegal search and also because the evidence was insufficient. I'd like to reserve about 4 minutes for rebuttal. This case begins based on a call from Mrs. Miller, who thought Mr. Trogdon was rifling through a nightstand of hers looking for cash. She had suspected that years before, cash was missing. In fact, one of the issues in this case is the length of time between when people missed things and when things were found. What happened was then the La Plata Sheriff's Department, La Plata County Sheriff's Department, Archuleta County Sheriff's Department got together and started comparing notes. And on November 30 of 2011, 2010, I'm sorry, a search warrant was executed. It was first sworn out days before that. It's important to know that earlier Mr. Trogdon had been arrested for some of the crimes. The detail of the crimes is important, and I've laid those out in the brief. Quite frankly, we don't have the time this morning for me to go into each one of the separate crimes charged, those that were charged. There were counts of acquittal, there were counts of conviction. When the La Plata County Sheriff's Department came to Mr. Trogdon's home on November 30, 2011, I believe that's the right date, I should know it, whatever the first search was, they come to his house, he lets them in, and there's some, it's not clear from the record of the hearing on suppression, which happened in September, I keep saying 2011. The suppression hearing is in 2011. The search is in 2010, okay? He lets them in, he lets the officers in, and there are a number of officers, anywhere from 8 to 15, depending on which officer we believe. One officer from La Plata County, he testified first at the suppression hearing in September, and that's a very important hearing to look at. That is in the record, the transcript of that hearing. And he testified there were maybe 12 or 15 officers. The La Plata County Sheriff Department who took over the search, Archuleta County, and that would be George Barter was the officer who came. He kind of was there because they had an interest, but he didn't actively participate in the search. La Plata County did. That would have been Dan Patterson, and he was the officer who was in charge. Mr. Trogdon cooperated. What does that mean? And that's an issue in this case, because the trial court found as a very important fact, ultimately, that Mr. Trogdon's cooperation was helpful. But I want to try and sort out for the court what happened on this morning of the search. By most accounts, it takes about 3 hours. They're looking for specific and particular items pursuant to the search warrant. Guns, jewelry, cash. The guns are identified. The jewelry is identified. The cash, not so much, just cash. They're hoping to find much more cash than they did. They get to the house. Mr. Trogdon cooperates, although, according to Officer Barter, he was free to go around the house as he wanted. According to Officer Patterson, again, not so much. There was a uniformed officer watching him at all times, which is the standard procedure, at least in my experience, in a search where you don't have an arrested suspect. And he was not under arrest, but he was not free to go either. He couldn't have left the house. At one point, his truck was in the way of a garage that was part of the search, and he offered to move his truck, and at that, Officer Patterson told him, no, we'll take care of it for you. He was not able to touch the guns. He was not able to move about without being under constant supervision by officers. So that part of Officer Barter's testimony seems to be contradicted by Officer Patterson. Why does that matter? It matters because the people have argued that Mr. Trogdon's cooperation undoes any taint in the search. Mr. Trogdon's position is this, as his lawyer, here's the position. Whether he cooperates or doesn't cooperate, they had a search warrant. They could have broken any lock, testified to by Officer Barter and Officer Patterson. They could have gone anywhere on the property that the search allowed. That's what they did. He made it easier in the cross-examination of both Detective Barter and Detective Patterson, make it clear that he was concerned about his home. He didn't want them busting things up. So he said, here, I got the key. I'll open that up for you.
But pardon me, Mr. Jaff, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but let's say for purposes of argument that we agree with you and that this really isn't a consent situation, and that deciding this case, again, hypothetically, comes down to the application of the plain view doctrine. Okay? So they're in the house legally, and the question becomes, as they look at these guns and this jewelry, whether they have probable cause to believe that those items were products of other burglaries or not. Because, as you know, Hicks suggests if there is probable cause to believe that an item was stolen or something like that, the cops can move it and look at it. If there's not, then they shouldn't be moving to look at it. So let's address that.
Okay. They don't have the facts of the case, the conduct of the officers is clear. They have to move weapons to get serial numbers. Now, this gets confusing, and that's not my words. That's the trial judge's words. Before we even begin the suppression hearing, there's a colloquy between counsel and the judge about the confusing nature of all this. And it is, I have to make a chart. It's a multi-page chart of all the counts. Now, to answer your Honor's question, Judge Bernard, there was no probable cause. Officer Patterson admits that on both direct and cross. He has some suspicion that because he sees a lot of things and because he'd heard that people had lost stuff, that there was maybe something here. But what happens? Factually, he has to get the serial numbers. And we argue that in the brief. He has to turn guns over. He has to open scabbards. He has to write down the numbers. He then goes away. He arrested Mr. Trogdon for the second time. Takes him to the jail. Mr. Trogdon bonds out. But while he's in the jail, Mr. Trogdon and Officer Patterson have a conversation. And in that conversation, Officer Patterson admits, and he says on the stand, well, I looked at the serial numbers, so I'd like to come and get some more guns from you this afternoon. That's in the jail. Mr. Trogdon bonds out. He goes home. That afternoon, sure enough, Officer Patterson comes to the gate where Mr. Trogdon had let him in earlier that day. And Mr. Trogdon says, you know, well, my lawyer says I shouldn't talk to you and I shouldn't give you the guns. Officer Patterson, well, I just want to take the guns we discussed in jail today. Officer Patterson goes in. He did not have even reasonable suspicion. Why? Because when he took the guns in the morning, I'm sorry, Aaron.
Yeah, if I may. The guns that they took in the morning were only part of the things that they had suspected that Mr. Trogdon had stolen. And they had reports beyond those guns of other guns that had been stolen, for example. In fact, there was a suggestion that Mr. Trump, at that point, there were eight or so additional burglaries that they were investigating. Why isn't that probable cause to believe we've got trouble with these guns here that are specifically stated in the warrant, so we come and find those? We also believe that he was involved in other burglaries in which firearms were seized. Why isn't that probable cause for them to be able to take a look at the weapons that they find in the house?
Get a search warrant.
They had a search warrant.
No, not for those eight guns. They didn't. The specificity of the warrant on that November morning was for three guns, not eight or 11 or 12. They took the ones that were specified in the warrant. He then has to turn over, and I'm stepping, can you hear me all right? Because I have to, there's a lot of feedback. I'm sorry. How about right there? So he has to go back. He goes to his tech people. In that meantime, he wrote down the serial numbers. How does he get the serial numbers? He has to move the guns to do it. He has to open scabbards to do it. They have to move the weapons from where they were to see the serial numbers. He then goes back to the office. His tech people check in with ATF to see if the weapons are stolen. He comes back, says, oh, yeah, they're stolen. We found them here. And so, Mr. Trogdon, I'd like to take them. My lawyer says I shouldn't talk to you about it. Well, you can just give me the 8 guns we talked about earlier today, can't you? So then he does. But there's no warrant at that point. And as I read through my brief, and I'd like to clear up what could be considered somewhat, it may not be clear, we're talking about a warrant, a search with a warrant, and a warrantless search. It's the afternoon of that day that's the warrantless search. He comes back without a warrant at that point. And that's the problem. And he only got the information from the morning's session when he is looking at weapons, moving them, turning them over. And that's the Conley matter. That's the Conley case. And that is what is prohibited. And it's the fruit of that that we're asking that your honors see that the court violated my client's constitutional rights in allowing that and trying to bootstrap everything. I have my 4 minutes here, and I will leave those if I may.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Victoria Cisneros, registration number 45519, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado in this matter. The main issue in this case is whether the actions of the police on November 30th were reasonable. In this case, there was an initial search that was authorized by the warrant, and in the warrant, there were three particular guns described. One of those guns included the serial number. There was also jewelry and cash described. As the officers searched, they began to turn over guns, which was within the scope of the search warrant. This warrant listed very particular guns. They're within their right to search anywhere that they could find those items while conducting this search. This included opening gun scabbards, opening gun cases, and turning over weapons to determine if these guns were the guns they were looking for. That includes recording serial numbers. Because those are within the scope of the search warrant, the officers did nothing unreasonable by recording those serial numbers. This was an ongoing investigation, as the court has noted. There were multiple investigations, there were multiple victims, there were multiple reports coming in.
Excuse me, Ms. Cisneros. Is there anything in the record about when the officers determined that they had the three firearms that were listed in the original search warrant?
Ultimately, they only found one item during that search, which was the Henry Big Boy rifle, which they was described, and also they had the serial number for. And on page 66 of the suppression hearing, Officer or Detective Patterson states that he found this about halfway through the search and before they investigated the pesticide shed.
So as they were, is it your position then, as the officers were continuing to look in gun cases, gun scabbards, and looking at serial numbers, that they were still looking for the other two
guns
that were listed on the original search warrant?
Exactly, Your Honor. They were still looking for the guns that were listed within the search warrant.
Counsel, if, I can't remember the exact specifies, but let me just hypothetically, let's say the other two rifles, one was were both Winchester rifles. They come upon a Remington rifle. Are they entitled to then take the serial number of the Remington rifle, knowing that that does not fall within the description of the search warrant?
I would argue that they are allowed to record that serial number. In Hicks, they stated that yes, that is a search as it relates to their initial search. In Hicks, the question was the officers had entered the apartment under exigent circumstances looking for a shooting victim. They noticed the squalid state of the apartment, and then noticed some high-priced stereo equipment. The officer then went over and looked at the stereo equipment and moved it to see if, to record that serial number to see if it was stolen, because he suspected that it was. This court in that case said that that was unrelated to their initial legitimate intrusion and therefore constituted a separate search. When their initial intrusion here is authorized by a warrant and they're looking for rifles and guns and things of that nature, that is all related to their initial search. And so I would argue under Hicks, recording the serial numbers is allowed. Even if not, there is the question of consent in this case. While the officers had a warrant and they were allowed to search everywhere, the defendant's actions here went far and above simply cooperating. He was under no obligation to do anything more than stand back and say, go ahead and search wherever you want, because that's what they were allowed to do. Instead, he pointed out an attic that they missed and said, there, you get through my attic here, it's padlocked, here's the key, and here's a ladder. In the pesticide shed, yeah, I have some guns in there. Let me move my truck and unlock that for you, and I'll go in and take the guns out for you. For officer safety purposes, the officers aren't going to allow him to do that, which they didn't. And instead, they moved the truck and pulled the guns out as well. But these actions by the defendant were far and above what he was required to do under the search warrant. And in addition, even if the defendant's actions weren't consent, the officers only actually seized one item, and that was the item that was authorized by the search warrant. That was the Henry Big Boy rifle. The other eight guns that were seized that day, actually I believe it's nine guns, the other nine guns that were seized that day were voluntarily relinquished by the defendant to the officers after he had been arrested, bonded out of jail, spoken to his attorney who told him, don't talk to the cops and don't give them any guns. When Detective Patterson went back, he said to him, my lawyer told me not to do this. And Detective Patterson said, I just want those ones, just those that we were talking about. And the defendant invited them onto his property and helped them locate those guns. Once again, he voluntarily relinquished these guns to the police. This was not a seizure. This was a voluntary relinquishment where the defendant had been given advice of counsel and chose to disregard that advice. And in addition, while they're on the property, he told the officers multiple times, take all the guns. There are 42 guns found on the property. He tells them, take them all. The officers say, no, we don't want to take those ones. We only want to take the ones we know are stolen, in an abundance of caution.
Pardon me for interrupting, Ms. Cisneros, but I want to explore a little more about whether the officers were acting within the scope of the warrant as they were identifying the guns as they went through the property. Obviously, the warrant allows them to go onto the property and seize the things that are specifically described. And we know that the plain view doctrine allows them, would allow them to seize things that they discover in places where the warrant allows them to be, they have probable cause to believe are contraband, i.e., you know, drugs or stolen property. Did they have probable cause to believe, let's begin with the rifles and the other firearms, that these firearms were stolen firearms, the ones that they moved in order to see the serial numbers?
I believe with the rifles, they moved them in order to determine if they were the rifles they were looking for. And because they had the serial number of the Henry Big Boy rifle, looking at the serial numbers and moving the rifles, I believe was within the scope of the search warrant.
They knew that that there had been other burglaries, and they suspected Mr. Trogdon as the burglar, right?
Yes. At that point, yes.
And they knew what had been taken in those burglaries.
Yes, I believe they did. And as it was coming in, more information was coming in. And the things that had typically been stolen were jewelry, firearms, and cash.
Okay.
And so when we're looking at the rifles, I believe those are within the scope of the search warrant.
Let me ask you this. If they were moving the rifles, turning them over to look at serial numbers to see if the rifles were the ones listed in the original search warrant, correct?
Yes.
And let's say they turn one over and they look at the serial number and they say, nope, this is not one that's on the original search warrant. What justifies the officers in then writing down and recording the serial number, make, model, and other information about that rifle, which they've already determined is not on the search warrant?
It's simply just gathering information because they know that they have an ongoing investigation with, at that point, a countless number of victims. And this is going to aid them in finding the property that belongs to those victims. And recording that information, as in Hicks, is not a seizure. There was no interference of the defendant's possessory interest. There was simply a search that was within the scope of the search warrant to record those numbers. And that is exactly what Hicks says. It's definitely a search. But here it was within that scope.
But if they're looking, because they're looking for firearms and jewelry and cash, does that mean that any firearms, any jewelry, and any cash they come across, they have probable cause to believe that those items are contraband or related to criminal conduct?
Based on the sheer number of victims, the sheer number of firearms, and then finding a stolen rifle on the defendant's property, in addition to the defendant's statements, when they asked the defendant about the Henry Big Boy rifle, he said, "Oh, I bought that one at a swap meet, and if it's stolen, I bet two others that I bought with it are." At that point, I would argue that the officers had reasonable probable cause to believe that all of the weapons on the property were potentially stolen property that belonged to a victim of the crime. This was by the defendant's own admission that if one of those was stolen, probably more of them were, and so they should take all of the guns. The defendant is relinquishing his weapons repeatedly to the officers, which they are declining, and instead, in an abundance of caution, trying to make sure that they don't interfere with the defendant's possessory interest in anything that does lawfully belong to him, taking the serial numbers so they can determine exactly what is stolen and what is not stolen. If the court has no further questions, I would respectfully request that you affirm the defendant's convictions.
Thank you, counsel.
I might have a second. I think I got a problem. We're good.
Good.
Okay.
You have 4 minutes left.
Thank
just
you.
As you proposed.
Okay. I want to finish up with the discussion on the search, and in due respect to Mrs. Cisneros, say that the response to Judge Bernard's question is incorrect. Yes, Hicks allows some view. Plain view is fine. But we're missing a very important point here, and that is something has to be immediately apparent. So if an officer has to look at a serial number on a weapon, I suppose if he knew the serial number at that point, he turned over the weapon, he sees the serial number, has it committed to memory, and says, "Oh, I saw the telex this morning, and that's a stolen weapon." That's immediately apparent. I might have a problem here today. But he doesn't do that. That's exactly the problem, and that's what we're arguing. They had to look at all the serial numbers. They had to go back to the department. They had to check with ATF. That's not immediate, and it's clearly not apparent. Because if you have to go to another agency to find out the status of a thing, that's not apparent. That requires more work.
But that appears to be far beyond the requirement of probable cause. If it's necessary to be immediately apparent by reason of knowing the serial number as a stolen weapon, that seems to be certainty, not probable cause.
All right, so Your Honor, in all due respect, let's not confuse apples and oranges. They had probable cause to get a search warrant. They had probable cause for weapons 1, 2, and 3. They had probable cause for certain jewelry. They had probable cause for certain cash. The people are saying when they get to the house and they find more weapons that are specifically listed in the warrant and more jewelry than is specifically arrested, Hicks and then Connolly narrowing Hicks down, Hicks the U.S. Supreme Court case, Connolly our case in Colorado, narrowing it down, says at that point, you wanted 3 weapons? We'll get you 3 weapons if you can find them. But if you have a 4th weapon that's not part of the listing, you need to see it. It's got to have some, you have to have some reasonable suspicion, and it has to be immediately apparent that weapon number 4 in my example can be seized. That's the problem here. If you have to take number four, turn it over, write down its number, run back to your police station, call ATF, say, I got the serial number on a weapon, a Winchester, whatever it is, a handgun, tell me if it's stolen, it's certainly not immediate, and it's by no means apparent. That's the problem.
Pardon me, Mr. Jaffa.
Yes.
Why couldn't the police officers, understanding, I think they had 18 or 20 burglaries by this time, and you're talking firearms in most, if not all of them.
There were a number. I think it's
why couldn't that point. They just seize them all right then and there? Say, we're taking all these guns now.
Because they don't have probable cause.
Well, if they have probable cause to believe that Mr. Trogdon was involved in all of these burglaries, and there are items similar to what they find there, why isn't that probable cause?
Because that's only reasonable suspicion, and these are, it may sound like hair splitting, but this is what the Fourth Amendment requires. I come in with a warrant that says XYZ. All I can take is XYZ unless within my plain view for my own protection, I see something is immediately apparent, I can take it. That is true under Hicks and Conley. But if those elements are not met, I can't take the thing. I can go back to my office, write up a new warrant, and come back, which is what I'm arguing Officer Patterson should have done. Having said that, I'm not abandoning the second issue, sufficiency of the argument. I've got 2 seconds left, unless there's another question, I need to sit down.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And court thanks both counsel for your excellent arguments. Those arguments will be very helpful to the court in reaching a decision in this case. The matter will now stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. At this point, the court